So we're going to now begin our journey through what we know, thanks to archaeology mainly, of what happened between the 13th and the 9th century. I've chosen those centuries because that's pre the writing in Sumeria and the earliest written prophets. You're looking at a map or two maps. One of them is just a general geography of the area, and the other is where the 12, it's a bit arbitrary, tribes are located, and you'll see that they actually fit. Looking at the geographical map, the white part is basically sand and lowlands, and the etched part here is the highlands. There's a transverse valley there called the Valley of Jezreel or Esdraelon. Otherwise, it's all vertical. And that's the Jordan River there, of course. And here you've got the high plateau of the Transjordan area. If you look at the area of the tribes as they're located, you'll see they're in a slightly darker... That's the highlands area. There's Judah, with Simeon down here, but Simeon soon vanishes. It's too small and it just gets, the Philistines just conquer it. Then you've got Dan used to be there, but once again, the Philistines conquered that. It was too vulnerable. So they moved right up to the north where they were safer. But on the whole, that's where the tribes were on both the Transjordan side and the Israel side. The end of the Bronze Age was a time of great turmoil in the ancient Near East. Perhaps the most significant factor in this was the collapse of the Hittite Empire in central Anatolia. Anatolia means the rising sun. So from the Greek point of view, they looked east and they called what we now call Turkey Anatolia. So this Hittite Empire collapsed in that area of what we will call Turkey. Unattached groups roamed through the area, seizing power where they could. Canaan was significantly affected. Bands of, and now I'm quoting from the book of Joshua, Amorites, Perizzites, Canaanites, Hittites, Girgashites, Hivites, and Jebusites. That was a list known at the time that Joshua was written by the Deuteronomists years later. They took control of the cities. This is actually quite important. And reduced the locals to serfdom. The local people, original people of this area, were just the farmers without any power. Some of the locals fled to the hill country to get away from the oppression of these little disparate marauding groups that are from the broken part of Turkey. They fled to the hill country where they were less able to be controlled and where they struggled to eke out an existence. Harder up there because of the very hilly country. Another empire that collapsed at the end of the Bronze Age, and you know this from the reading of Homer, was the Mycenaean Empire. This is the period of the Battle of Troy. It led to the same kind of uncontrolled marauding now at sea. The sea peoples, they're often called in literature from this area, attacked Egypt. They also attacked along the east coast of the Mediterranean, including Canaan. And one of the groups of sea peoples that came in from the Mediterranean, not from the land, from Turkey, one of the groups are the Philistines, 13th century BC. Now, to get some idea of the early history of Israel, we turn to the discoveries of archaeology. Our earliest glimpse into Canaan comes from the Amarna tablets from the 14th century, that's the 1300s BC. They consist in correspondence between Egypt and, I'll call them cities in Canaan. And the ones that we find mainly are here, Jerusalem, Lachish, Shechem, Megiddo, and Hazor, the ones in blue in that map, letters written there from the Egyptians. The Egyptian provincial capital was here at Gaza, and they also had military fortifications at Joppa and at Beth Shan. What the tablets reveal was that the cities that we've talked about there were quite weak. They were paying heavy tribute to their Egyptian overlord. They had no walled cities. They consisted of little more than a palace for the local, inverted commas, king, a temple compound, and a few public buildings, and no walls. So there's nothing powerful about them. And they're inhabited by different groups. Jerusalem, the one that interests us most probably, was Jebusites there. And there are other different groups in different places, all quite independent. It was in the hill country of Canaan at this time that new groupings of tribes emerged. And the new grouping is called Israel. The oldest extant record of the existence of a people called Israel is an Egyptian stone inscription from the time of Merneptah, the son of the famous pharaoh Ramses II. And it's at the end of the 13th century. It talks about this group called Israel, 1207, the earliest record of that word being used. Israel Finkelstein, in his The Archaeology of the Israelite Settlement, notes evidence of an increase in settlement in the highlands of Canaan in the 13th century BC. And he writes, and this is so important and very different from what you read in the Bible, the vast majority of the people who settled in the hill country and in the Transjordan during Iron One period, late 1200s, must have been indigenous. They were always there. So you get the impression from the book of Joshua that they all escaped from Egypt, came over, and with God's command, killed as many of the locals as they could, and this whopping big group called Israel comes in and takes over the land. That didn't happen. The tribes of Israel were always there. They're indigenous, and they've come up to the highlands for protection against the marauding, mainly of the Philistines and other sea peoples. In other words, these inhabitants, tribal inhabitants, did not come from outside and occupy the land by an invasion. Their settlements were not fortified. They lived in simple lifestyle and they settled in the hill country. It was peaceful. Archaeology reveals earlier similar settlements in the highlands of Canaan. The first being about 3500 BC, and archaeology has discovered 100 sites that go back to then. The second, about 2000 BC, there are 220 sites that they can locate by the pottery and all the rest of things that they're all experts at. And the people called Israel represent the third such attempt at subsistence farming in the highlands of Canaan. The tribes of Israel were held together by an understanding of God that was new and very different from that of any of their neighbours. For this people, God was not a God of the controlling elite, nor was God a God identified with a specific geographical area, a river, a mountain, a whatever. He was the God of creation, the Lord of history, a God who liberated from slavery, a God whose concern was for the poor, an absolutely new idea. They believed that it was this God, whom they called Yahweh, which comes from the verb to be, the one who is, the one who will be, the being, you know, whatever word you're going to put there. They didn't categorize it any smaller than that. This is Yahweh. I will be who I will be. They believed it was their God, Yahweh, who chose Israel, this highland area, as his special people and gave them Canaan as their land. For them, the cult, the religious worship, was not there to provide mythical support for a ruler. It was a way to come together to celebrate the freedom that God had given them, to remember and express their worship, their gratitude and their obedience to Yahweh, who they believed had entered into a special covenant with them. He would be their God and they would be his people. So let's look at the book of Joshua. The book of Joshua tells us that this new way of looking on God was introduced to the people of the hill country by a group that entered Canaan at that time, a group that had escaped Egyptian slavery. And it's a story of the spread of this idea and the forming of a people committed to Yahweh. It tells of the early years of what was to become the nation of Israel. If we're going to find a hero in the book of Joshua, then it's Yahweh. It's Yahweh who liberates these people and who defends them against the powerful enemies of the city-states of Canaan, Beth Shan, Lachish, and Jerusalem, etc. It's Yahweh who inspires other subject groups to join them and to identify as a people with a common commitment to this God, Yahweh. So it's clear that the account given in the book of Joshua is not historical. Here's some reasons. One, Egyptian control, which I've already pointed out, of Canaan wouldn't have allowed the Canaanite city-states to be overrun. What do you think the Egyptians at Gaza and Joppa and Beth Shan are doing while Joshua comes in, knocks everybody off? They wouldn't have lasted a week against Egypt. Second, Jericho, everyone knows the story of Jericho, at the time that we're talking about, the late 1200s, there were no walls around Jericho. There had been walls centuries before and they were knocked down. So Joshua fit the Battle of Jericho all very well, because when the story is told, there are no walls. Jericho, walls have been collapsed. So who did it? Joshua, God. No, wait a minute. It was done hundreds of years before then, but they could see this city, and so they linked it to their story. They talk about one of the second places that was destroyed by Joshua, if you read the book of Joshua, was a place called Ai. Now that was already uninhabited at this time. But people saw the tell, and the stories of a mighty city that used to be there, well, God, through Joshua, destroyed it. No, he didn't. But that's the story. That's how they link their history with the local scenery. Now, a number of cities in Canaan were destroyed. They know this from fire and all that stuff. In the late 13th century, which fits with the story of Joshua. Here's a number of them that were destroyed around this time. Debir, Bethel, Lachish, and Hatzor. So that's interesting. Now this destruction could have resulted from the clash between Egypt and the Hittites at this time. It could have been the result of struggles between the various city-states themselves, as trade was disrupted by the ravages brought about by the sea peoples, including the Philistines. They were destroyed at this time, but who was destroying them? We don't know exactly, but it could have been either of those. And it's likely that the sea peoples themselves were the main cause of the destruction of these small city-states in Canaan, and so of the need for the herders to escape the disorder of the plains and settle in the highlands, the people we're calling Israel. After 1967, that's the war, as you know, archaeologists focused their attention on the central highlands. Now, about 1200 BC, there were 250 small hilltop subsistence villages sprang up. They came from somewhere. They're small. By 1000 BC, it's estimated that the total population of the central highlands, Israel, was about 45,000. So think of a place, I can't think of one for the moment, that has 45,000 in it. That's the population of the whole country. So we're not talking about a massive population yet. The emergence of early Israel was the outcome of the collapse of the Canaanite culture, not its cause. These are the people that fled from all this violence on the plains up into a safer area and had to battle with the trunkers. How do you do it? They had to build systems to hold the rain because there's no water except what comes from rain. And certainly months or half the year there's no rain. So they had to build these systems up there to hold the rain, etc., etc. It was difficult to do. There was no mass exodus from Egypt. There was no violent conquest of Canaan. Most of the people who formed early Israel were local people. That might be all new to you, but that's what archaeology proves. The book of Joshua, what is it? According to Finkelstein and Silb, Finkelstein's the archaeologist, Silbermann, they're both Jews, is a Jewish historian. The book of Joshua is, they say, a complex collection of legends, hero tales, local myths from various parts of the country that had been composed over centuries, built up as stories, and then finally written. It's a literary saga, probably put together during the reign of King Josiah, finally later, but probably then, to help create a pan-Israelite identity. Joshua's victories in the Judah and Benjamin areas encouraged Josiah's immediate goals. The victories in the north are a projection of Josiah's long-range ambitions. By now, I hope you're at home with that idea. We've covered it a number of times. It's interesting that the list of towns in Judah that you find in the book of Joshua exactly correspond with the borders of Judah during the reign of King Josiah. The towns that are named are the towns at the time of Josiah that are mentioned in the book of Joshua. Of course they are. Whether they were there at the book of Joshua, probably not. But he's writing, the document's being written for real people, engaging them in a project. These tribes inhabited the mountainous region of Canaan, and the thorough and extensive archaeological surveys carried out since 1967 particularly reveal a culture different from that of the city-states. And agricultural lands of the coastal plains and lowlands. The Israelites were herders who had turned to farming when the collapse of law and order in the lowlands meant they could no longer rely on traditional barter. They couldn't go down and swap their whatever they had, their skins and their meat, for whatever they needed. They had to provide their own grain on the eastern highlands, that is, facing the Jordan River, as well as vines and olives on the western facing the Mediterranean. The key historical question is this: where did the highland tribes, Israel, hear about and embrace the worship of Yahweh? And we can't give you a historically certain answer to that. We're dealing now with probabilities. The answer given in the Bible tells of a group of slaves who escaped from Egypt and, after journeying in the Sinai Desert, crossed the Jordan River, entered Canaan from the east. The books of the Bible that tell this story, you know them, the Torah, form the heart of the Old Testament. In them we have story rather than history, as we would use the term. But the stories and legends draw on a long oral tradition and do express the essential identity of Israel. As the story goes, this group originated in Canaan, see the stories of Abram, Isaac, Jacob and Joseph. It was Psalm 105, I think, that was brought up yesterday. It's about that, the early beginnings when Abram went there. He didn't own anything there. He was just travelling around, and then his son, inverted commas, and grandson, inverted commas, it's not a biological statement, it's a linking of tribe statement, they were all in this land as strangers. They formed into a people during their years in the Sinai Desert and had a unique understanding of God as the God of the oppressed. Now, in an attempt to ward off the incursions of the sea peoples, Pharaoh Ramses II, 1279 to 1213, was building fortified cities in the land of Goshen, in the eastern delta of the Nile, near the Mediterranean, of course. And what he did was he used forced labour of refugees, and these refugees were referred to as Habiru. And Habiru in Semitic means without borders, without a state, people who don't belong anywhere. Stateless people. They were without any protection. They had no one to defend them. And mercenary armies pillaged their way through the Near East and profiting from ready market in slaves. So these are slaves in Egypt from everywhere, particularly Canaan, because it's right next door. It's to a group of these stateless and nondescript Habiru that we can look for the historical core of the epic that has such a central place in the later literature of the Israelites. As Finkelstein and Silbermann say, the escape of more than a tiny group from Egyptian control at the time of Ramses II seems highly unlikely, as is the crossing of the desert and the entrance into Canaan. Except for the Egyptian forts along the northern coast, not a single campsite or sign of occupation from the time of Ramses II and his immediate predecessors and successors has ever been identified in Sinai. Not even a single shard. So there's no archaeological evidence of any substantial group of people, in fact of anyone, coming from Egypt through the desert Sinai at this time, the presumed time of the Moses story. Signs of habitation in the Sinai, which you can see the map of there, from the third millennium have been found, but not from the 13th century. If the escaping slaves were at Kadesh Barnea, and you get the impression from the story that they were there for 38 years, that was where they basically settled. Kadesh Barnea is here, just below Canaan. They couldn't get in because of the Amalekites and the story, they were too strong. So the story has them coming from here, wherever, and then they go to there and kind of stay there for a long time and eventually have to come this way. If the escaping slaves were at Kadesh Barnea, they left no trace. You can't not leave a trace. There are no traces at Ezion Geber either, down here on the Gulf of Aqaba. In the 13th century, Arad was deserted in the 13th century. Heshbon, the city of Sion, and the Psalms are full of it, how God, through Moses, killed the king of... Well, I'm sorry to tell you, but Sion didn't even exist. Heshbon, the city, didn't exist in the 13th century. Edom and Ammon, what were they? They were sparsely populated by nomadic tribes. They weren't a state. But they were, it took the time of the writing, of course. So they're imagined as being back there. But they weren't there. Like the patriarchal narrative, the Exodus story supported the ambitions of King Josiah. It's likely that work was done to gather the traditions into a document during his reign. Reading again from Finkelstein and Silbermann, new layers could be added to the Exodus story in subsequent centuries, during the exile in Babylon and beyond, but we can now see how the astonishing composition came together under the pressure of a growing conflict with Egypt in the 7th century BC. The saga of Israel's exodus from Egypt is neither historical truth nor literary fiction. It's a powerful expression of memory and hope born in a world in the midst of change. The confrontation between Moses and Pharaoh mirrored the momentous confrontation between the young King Josiah and the newly crowned Pharaoh Necho of Egypt in the late 600s BC. And everyone reading it would have been able to relate to all that and imagine it as part of our original history. The biblical text that we've got is liturgical. It's exhortatory, it's dramatic. The lack of corroboration from outside the Bible is no reason to doubt, these are my words now, my attempt to make sense of it, no reason to doubt that there were a historical kernel at the source of the Moses narratives that are central to the Torah. It was perhaps a small group of enslaved Habiru, led by Moses, and we don't know Moses' name. You've heard of Ramses, I suppose, and there's a number of the M-S-E-S at the end of an Egyptian means son of. So the name Moses isn't really a name, it's son. Ramses is the son of Ra. So Moses probably originally had an Egyptian name, all right, as is Miriam and Aaron. So we've got an Egyptian name with the God cut off because it's not Yahweh. So they've truncated the name. It's perhaps a small group of enslaved Habiru led by someone who came down through the tradition to be called somethingses, who made their escape into the Egypt Sinai Peninsula at this time. Not being strong enough to force their way north, they spent a generation wandering the desert lands till they were able to enter Canaan from the east across the Jordan. During this long desert experience, they formed into a religious community, bound together not by race, the Habiru were from everywhere, not by geography, but by their commitment to each other and to God under the name of Yahweh, the liberator God whom they believed was responsible for their miraculous escape. It was they who introduced the cult of Yahweh to the highland tribes. That's my best suggestion to you. The tribes were always there. In fact, there's a hint of that in the Bible itself, because Joseph and Jacob came from Canaan and went down to Egypt. So these are the people that, you know, displace a whole people. And our group, smallish group, came in with a whole new idea of God that fitted the needs of the highland tribes. One can imagine the story of the Exodus holding a special power for the tribes of the hill country of Canaan that espoused this religion of Yahweh. Did they learn from a group of escaped slaves that came in from the wilderness to express their relationship with God in terms of a covenant? In his The Hebrew Bible, a social literary introduction, Norman Gottwald, another American scholar, lists the key experiences of the Confederacy, the tribal attempt to support each other, and why it was that the Exodus functioned as an umbrella metaphor for them. They too, these tribal groups, they too were a people oppressed by kings. They came together to escape from physical and mental bondage of the oppressor. So the story fits them beautifully. They too were a people freed from an imposed social order, and they came together to create an intertribal community of mutually supported equals. No king. They too were a people whose leaders had been imposed and who now struggled to create a new kind of leadership in the absence of coercive state power. They too were a people in very precarious economic situations. So of course they could read about their ancestors, slaves in Egypt, who are their ancestors, who formed them into a people, and they could hold on to that story. The tribes of Israel committed themselves to organize their communities on the principles of justice that followed from worshipping a God who hears the cry of the poor. Hence the amazingly beautiful stuff that you find in the Torah about caring for the resident foreigner, for the widow, for the orphan, leaving after you've cut your wheat. Don't go and do it a second time. Leave it there so that the poor can come in and clean and take what's left. And when you've pulled the fruit off the trees, don't pull it all off. Leave some for the poor. It's all there. It's entirely beautiful stuff. Decisions were supposed to be made in this group, and you find this in the Torah, not by custom, for custom benefited the status quo and proved ineffectual as an instrument of justice. Not by authoritarian law enacted by the powerful. Not by wisdom, which as practiced was a form of self-interested know-how for the benefit of those who were influential. And it wasn't to be made by necromancy, calling up the spirits of the dead, which the locals did, fate, chance, or random superstition. Decisions were to be made remembering the deeds of Yahweh and listening to the inspiring voice of Yahweh coming through the prophets. Success was to be measured not by the achievement of personal kudos, but by what gave glory to Yahweh. That is to say, by what attracted people to praise Yahweh and Yahweh's action in favor of the people. The land belonged to Yahweh, not to them. And so could be enjoyed, yes, by us in the highlands, but only as long as we're faithful to Yahweh. It's his special heritage, and he's given it to us. It's not ours. We have to nurture, protect it, and keep obeying. When the northern tribes met at the covenant shrine at Shechem, which was the central shrine of the Joseph tribes, and when the others came there, the various tribal ancestral legends were shared, and story of the Exodus was told and retold. Writing was a rare phenomenon in a peasant community where trade was mostly by barter. Traditions were handed on in oral form. Religious traditions found expression especially in liturgical forms and were committed to memory by usage. It's these traditions which are later written down and which we now read in the Torah. Knowledge of the oral origins of the material warns us against reading the biblical narrative outside such a context. we can be confident that we're reading material which puts us in touch with truth, so long as we recognize that it's the truth of religious experience expressed in the ritual language of worship. We're invited to see the continuing activity of God in each new present by recalling those events, inverted commas, of the past that have proven themselves to be of revelatory power. This is expressed well in a speech placed on the lips of Moses by the writers of the book of Deuteronomy. And if you read it in the context which I've tried to set for you, Deuteronomy 5:3 reads, Yahweh our God made a covenant with us at Horeb, the desert mountain. Not with our fathers did he make this covenant, but with us, all of us who are alive here today. That's the book of Joshua. So it's nice to be able to relax and realize that Yahweh never told Joshua to go in and slaughter all the men, women and kids. That's not a very healthy idea that comes from later. And it's really saying, don't intermarry, keep pure in your faith. Don't marry with Canaanites. Don't absorb their religious practices. Be pure. But there's a lot in it when you look at it from one angle, but the way it's expressed ends up with a dreadful image of God, which has nothing to do with anything. No one was conquered. People just thought, what a wonderful way to look at God. And gradually, superficially at first, more deep for others, absorbed it. So let's come to the book of Judges now, also part of the Deuteronomic writings. It's a compilation of epic stories of people who were significant in one or other of the tribal areas during the 12th and 11th centuries prior to the monarchy. From the death of Joshua to the emergence of the king. The emergence of Israel in Canaan was indeed revolutionary. It included a social and political experiment that was incomprehensible to the traditional power groups in Canaan, or to the enterprising Philistines who settled along the Mediterranean coast shortly after Israel emerged in the hill country. It's no surprise that the Israelite movement met constant resistance. As is clear from the book of Joshua, it was restricted to the highlands and the Negev, the southern desert part, highlands, and its survival even there of Yahwism was precarious. So the Philistines came into Palestine during the 12th century as part of the general invasion of the people to call the Sea Peoples. They entered from the Mediterranean at about the same time that the escaped Egyptian slaves crossed the Jordan. The Philistines could make iron, which gave them decided advantage in war, especially on level terrain. For two centuries, they controlled the coastal area and the plain of Esdraelon, that's the transverse valley. But the Israelites in the hill country managed to fend off the chariots of the Philistines, and they even managed some important victories in battle. However, towards the end of the 11th century BC, the Philistines pushed their way, according to the record, right up to the central shrine of Shiloh. And this is mentioned by the prophet Jeremiah, and captured the Ark of the Covenant, Yahweh's mobile throne. This is living memory now. No one would have forgotten a thing as dramatic as that. They were battling with the Philistines. You can read it there. And so they thought, well, we'll bring God in. So God came. God is invisible, of course, but he's seated on the throne, the mobile throne, which is the Ark of the Covenant. And when they brought that into the battlefield, of course, the Philistines are terribly afraid. But the Philistines decide to attack, and heavens, they actually captured the Ark. So what does that do to the religious perception of these people, that this magic God would always be with them, fighting with them? So they decided they'd have to do something more. They'll need a monarch like every other country. So the birth of the monarchy. And this is the part that I read on. It's all here, and it's not in your book, but it's in that page. I've just reshaped it a bit. So let's come to the period of the monarchy. The need for defence against the Philistines led to the development of centralised government in the north, that's, we'll call it the Kingdom of Israel, and in the south, the Kingdom of Judah. Some later writers saw the decision to have a king as Yahweh's answer to the people's cry. Others saw it as a failure to trust in Yahweh, and you can find both views side by side in the Bible. In other words, they weren't sure which it was. There's a bit of this and a bit of that. The prophet Samuel, the last of the judges, and here he is, the prophet, was exercising his prophetic ministry at the time of the emergence of the monarchy, 1000 BC. Material concerning him is included in the prophetic scrolls named after him, composed by the same writing school that produced the book of Deuteronomy. Though we sometimes speak of the books as history, you're probably bored with me telling you this, it's important to note that in the Tanakh, they're called the scrolls of the prophets, Samuel in this case. All the archaeological evidence points to there being two distinct kingdoms in the central highlands, one ruled from Shechem and the other from Jerusalem, after it was finally conquered by David. That was his own city. He conquered it, so he owned it, so he could go there and have it as his own little area of control, and then they made him king at Hebron. They don't grow out of an earlier political unity, which you get that impression in the Bible, ruled from Jerusalem by David and Solomon. Judah was always the poorer of the two and began to achieve importance only when the refugees from the north came down and the city expanded and it became the only tribal area and all the energy came there. Prior to that, it was country bumpkin down south. The biblical picture enables the writers from Judah to speak of an unconditional covenant given from God to David. The division between north and south, which they all experienced, is portrayed as a temporary punishment because of Solomon's infidelity. And with the end of the kingdom of Israel, the king of Judah inherited the promise made to David, which covers the lot, and Josiah will take advantage of it. So let's look at the biblical account of the Davidic dynasty in Judah. According to the idealized biblical account, David was a brilliant military general from Judah. He probably was. He captured Jerusalem, the Jebusite city that stood between Judah and Ephraim. He set it up as a new capital of the United Kingdom. His military campaigns brought under Israelite control the whole of the land corridor between the Arabian Desert and the Mediterranean, the whole of Canaan, according to the idealized account of the Bible. This meant control of the lucrative trade between Egypt and Arabia to the south and the whole of Europe and Asia to the north. You couldn't travel through the desert, and there's the sea Mediterranean there. There's this narrow corridor between Egypt and everywhere else. So it's a terribly important area, fought over. Including the two main caravan routes, the Way of the Sea and the King's Highway. The newly conquered agricultural land of the plain, plus the taxes from trade, brought wealth and prosperity as well as peace to this new kingdom. This at last was the promised land, according to the biblical account, for which they'd according to the same idealized biblical account, Solomon, David's son, inherited this prosperity and used it to attempt to set up a royal court around himself to vie with those of the powerful neighboring kingdoms, especially that of Egypt. He built a palace in Jerusalem and attached a temple to it, in which he attempted to centralize the worship. Do this, do to this, and due to this, and to develop other ambitious projects, he broke across tribal barriers and set up administrative districts to gather taxes and recruit forced labour. That's the impression you get from the books of Kings. The findings of archaeology require a drastic modification of the idealised picture of the Davidic kingdom that's given in the Bible. Archaeological excavation has concluded that at the time of David, there were about 500 locations of habitation in the mountainous area occupied by the Israelites, and the population is estimated at about 45,000 at the time of David. Jerusalem, the city of David, was quite small in the 10th century. Judah itself comprised only about 20 small villages and only a few thousand inhabitants. The suggestion is, was Judah probably had 5,000 inhabitants at the time of David? Doesn't sound like a mighty empire to me. And I did look this up. The population of Picton is about 5,000. So that might give us a local colour of how small this country is. It's significant that neither David nor Solomon is mentioned in any Egyptian or Mesopotamian texts. Well, if he's conquering the blooming area, you'd think they'd say something about it. There's nothing there. Our earliest mention of the house of David is an inscription discovered at Tel Dan, right in the north, in 1993. It seems to date from the campaign of Hazael of Damascus in 835 BC. There's no evidence of a conquest of Canaan by King David or of an extensive empire ruled by him. Improved carbon dating. They used to say that at the time of Solomon, that's when he owned all these fantastic places for military chariots, etc., in Hatzor in the north and Megiddo and all this. Well, improved carbon 14 dating indicates that the monumental gates and palaces of Megiddo on the east part of the transverse valley, Hatzor in the north, and Gezer in the south, they were once thought to have been built by Solomon. They come from the following century, 100 years later. The biblical narrative of the Golden Age under David, when the northern highlands of Israel and the kingdom of Judah in the south were united under one rule, is of the nature of a historical novel, expressing the 7th century ambitions of King Josiah and presenting these ambitions as divinely promised claims. Here, reading again from book, it's outside to look at if you want to, by Finkelstein and Silberman. Judah remained relatively empty of permanent population, quite isolated and very marginal, right up to and past the presumed time of David and Solomon, with no major urban centres and no pronounced hierarchy of hamlets, villages and towns. The devastation of the cities of the plain by the invasion of Pharaoh Sheshonk in 926 opened the way for the expansion of the kingdom of Israel, the north. Judah remained an isolated backwater. We're now in the late 10th century. It was the northern highlands that formed the first effective kingdom recognized by other powers in the region and named in their documents. Not Judah, not Jerusalem, not the house of David. Comprising as it did a number of different tribal groups, this is the kingdom of Israel, the dominant area, it lacked the dynastic stability of Judah. Leadership depended on military power, and the story of the Northern Kingdom is the story of frequent military coups. Unified ethnic consciousness coalesced slowly. And though Yahweh was worshipped as the chief god in the north, during this period it remained, like the kingdom of Judah, polytheistic. There's no monotheism existing at this time. Yahweh is the first of the gods. Yahweh is the one we should worship above all the other gods. I am the Lord your God, you shall not put strange gods before me. So there's a hierarchy of gods and Yahwehs at the top. But the idea of monotheism hasn't dawned. How could it? But it hadn't. The Deuteronomist names two sources upon which they are drawing for the list of kings of Judah and Israel at this time. It talks about the annals of the kings of Israel. What a pity it's no longer extant. And it talks about the annals of the kings of Judah. There's no reason to suspect the accuracy of their record of the kings and some of the battles that are pre-writing. When it comes to their judgment of the various kings, they make no attempt at offering an unbiased picture. Their judgment is clearly ideological. For example, we have to go outside the Bible to discover the significance of the Northern Kingdom, especially during the Omride dynasty. You'd never get it from the Bible, that they were anyone except nobody from outside. In fact, they had the largest army in the Middle East at this time, the North. At the end of Ahab's reign, 853 BC, Israel had the largest army in the Middle East. However, in 835 BC, Hazael of Damascus caused violent destruction in Israel, Damascus, that's Syria, and he built defensive forts at Hatzor, Bethsaida, and Dan. The collapse of Syria made possible Israel's recovery from that under the great king Jeroboam II in the north. It's important to keep remembering, and this is, I'm concluding with this, that the books of Samuel and Kings are listed in the Tanakh among the former prophets. They don't even use the word former. They're listed among the prophets. Their focus is on the kings. Why? To judge them in the light of how they responded to Yahweh. Better, how they were thought of as having responded. They couldn't have responded to Yahweh well, the kings of the north. Why? You can answer that for us. Because Israel was destroyed. Well, if it was destroyed, God's not going to destroy a country where people are faithful. It must have been that they were totally unfaithful with their idols and their polytheism, etc. And that's why the just God saw to their destruction and they never recovered from it. So that's a reason for judging badly all the kings. How a king in the north could have defended Israel against the might of Assyria, no one seems to have asked that question. Because armies are not what it's about. It's the gods that are controlling history as they saw it. The two most significant of the prophets of the 9th century BC are Elijah and Elisha. And as we read the legends attached to these prophets, we're to remember that the Deuteronomists want the reader to be watching what God is doing and watching it from the perspective of Judah.